Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Normally, we do this on Thursday, but because Wednesday is the new Thursday, Will Cosentini, Chef Kenny, and Tim Lynch will join me today. And joining me from Kansas City, the outskirts of that, is Will Cosentini. Will, how are you?
I'm great. It's a wonderful day here in the Midwest.
Always, always. You want to give us the weather? Give us the weather in the Midwest. What is it?
It's like every day from about May 15th to September 15th. 90-plus degrees and a little breezy.
Got it. All right. Joining me from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. Tim, how you doing?
Doing fine, Mac. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Give us a weather update from McAllen.
It is hot and humid and windy. Highs in the 90s where they'll stay until October. And a lot of wind right now for reasons I don't know. It's probably something going on in the Gulf.
Got it. And joining me from San Clemente, California, I think is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm good, and the weather here is, as usual, boringly okay.
Actually, a little bit
it's
on the
a little cloudy,
little on the cool cloudy. Side the last few days, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. The Will joined me on Monday, and we kind of dissected the news a little bit. We were talking about the whole what's being referred to now as Bounty Gate. So I want to let Tim and because. It's a story that, you know, is sucking the oxygen out of the room until it doesn't, and until the next shiny object appears. And so, but for those of us who've done work inside the DOD, we look at these things as serious matters. And so we'll talk about them in a serious way. And so, Tim, your thoughts on the whole story of Russian bounty.
It's a non-story. It's a ridiculous story for the exact reasons that you and Will talked about on Monday from the third order of effects thing. And if you turn it around and look at it from the Russian perspective of how you would do this, it becomes even more ridiculous because it doesn't make any sense. How are you going to figure out who did what and who's not lying to you? When you start talking to the Taliban about money, you're going to find all kinds of guys willing to step forward and say, oh, yeah, we did that. We did this. Sure, we'll take that money. I believe the CIA got burned by a fake Mullah Dadullah who had two eyes, not one eye, for $20-30 million back in 08, 09. I mean, they do that all the time. So it's a ridiculous story to begin with. And it's being covered as if it happened and this is a fact. And now all the coverage we're seeing is about who know what when. When in fact it's stupid to begin with, and most of the guys we lost the last 3 years were lost to ISIS anyway, so I don't buy it, and I'm disgusted with how much prominence it's gained in the media. It's just ridiculous to me.
All right, before Jeff lights his boiler off, what can you explain what you were talking about relative to? They'll say what they want, what you want them to say. Could you explain that? Because that was a phenomenon both in Iraq and Afghanistan. Explain that.
It is. Well, I think the best way to look upon this is information is monetized in Afghanistan. If you know something, you expect to be able to earn a little bit of coin of sharing that information. You know, organically within the society, not coin necessarily in coin of the realm, prestige or whatever. So nobody there keeps their mouth shut about any damn thing, for one. And for two, when there's money in line, when there's money on the offing that you can't tie to a concrete thing, because I'm taking a GRU agents aren't wheeling around the helmet in an unmarked car. That takes some doing. I don't think they can do it. If you're offering money where you can't verify what's happening, you're going to get all kinds of takers. So it's just the quest for easy money. that makes it a ridiculous assumption that they could get away with doing this and have any results whatsoever. They want to hurt the Americans. They should teach them a little trigonometry and they can learn how to aim their mortars better. That'd be all they need to do.
All right. No, but I mean, that was a serious issue. Not a serious issue, but I remember, I wish I could remember who was explaining it to me. It might've been Larry Nicholson. We were talking one night. And he says, well, you have to understand these people when you talk to the intel guys. Or I don't know. It might have been an intel guy. I can't remember. But somebody in Fallujah in 2006 was saying, you know, when they want to say what you want to hear. Right. And I was like, what? And they're like, no. They're trying to find out what you want them to say. And then they'll say that. I was like, all right. Jeff, your thoughts.
That's absolutely true. Both in Iraq and Afghanistan, if they think you want to hear something, they'll tell you. And, you know, they'll tell you what you want to hear. And not all. You know, I mean, not all. They're not all of a piece. But most of them are just like Tim said, you know, information is a commodity, you know, because it's valued. This thing with, you know, the bounty, you know, maybe the Russians tried to do that, but it certainly didn't really pay off. I mean, you know, an actual American dead. And again, like Tim said, most of those were, you know, ISIS. When ISIS piped up taking credit for stuff, you know, they didn't deny it or anything like that. The other thing is, I don't think the Taliban need any kind of monetary incentive to kill Americans. I mean, when General Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, when he visited in I think it was the autumn of 2017, they really tried hard to kill him. They tried hard to kill him with mortars and rockets, you know, short range. They risked themselves at the KIA, you know, the Kabul International Airport, plastering that thing with like a fire for effect type deal, and so. It just didn't make sense to me. But what does make sense to me is you kind of hit on it, the shiny object. It's like they get everybody they try to get everybody fired up like a bunch of young kids at a soccer game all chasing the ball and none of them, you know, none of them watching anything else because it kind of distracts from something that people might be – that they're worried about people noticing. That's what I think. And you know, I can't believe anything that comes out of the almost even Fox News. I only believe like a small amount of it anymore. It's like they are corrupted, and they've proven it again and again since 2016, since the summer of 2016. That you know, there's almost no story you can depend on. It's sad.
Hey, can I add something, Mac?
Yes, you have permission to do that.
Thanks. You would think the Russians would have problems operating in Afghanistan because the Afghans hate Russians, you would think. And I remember talking to a reporter who was going over to do a story. I think she was writing for Playboy. And and she was asking me about tips on how to get along with the Afghan SF. And I said, well, you speak Russian, right? Because she had told me she did. She said, yeah. I said, talk to him in Russian. You'll be instantly on the inside. And she was. She said it was remarkable. Everybody could speak Russian, and they all liked speaking Russian, and they thought it was cool I could speak Russian. Now, I've dealt with some Taliban guys too, and they aren't Russian speakers. As a matter of fact, I was waiting outside a village at dawn once in order to get invited in because we were doing some prospecting for looking for stuff, and an old guy came out with a rifle, and he asked if I was Russian. I said, no, I'm American. He goes, oh, good. Then I don't have to kill you. Why don't you come have some breakfast? And so that was the South. And that was a no shitter. It was like, yeah. So I don't even know if the Russians seem to have a lot of friends in Afghanistan, but they seem to be residing in Kabul, quite frankly.
And Tim, and then plus there's the whole Tajikistan bridge of friendship or whatever that bridge is. And, you know, and Kazakhstan and the countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union that border it.
Right.
The Soviets or the Russians still have pretty good relationships with their intel agencies. So, you know, there's a million ways. There's a million ways they could get that message across. And I'm surprised they even would trace it back to the Russians. They think the Kyrgyz or somebody or, you know, even the fucking even the guys in Waziristan were, you know, were fronting that money. Why would the Russians want people to know that they were the ones paying for it? You know, so
Will, any other thoughts on this subject since we last talked about this on Monday?
I would just say discussing the sort of hows and wheres and whatevers, you're down there sort of wrestling with the pigs, because that's what the narrative wants you to do. Step back for a second and think of the stuff that goes into the president's daily brief. If I'm the president of the United States and someone says to me, the Russians are paying bounties to kill Americans. Okay, so what's your point?
Yeah.
I mean, it's stupid on its premise. Our adversaries do all kinds of things all the time. What has that got to do with the president's daily brief? Are they getting ready to launch nuclear weapons off submarines that are suddenly surged to the East Coast? You know, have the Japanese sent 5 aircraft carriers to the northwest of Pearl Harbor? That's the kind of stuff that should be interesting. And then who shot John? Was it in the brief? Not in the brief. Republican senator saying, well, it might have been in the brief. It's utterly the whole thing.
Silly.
And it's unfortunate that the president sort of got into this. This is one, and I don't criticize him for jumping into the fray on things. But this is one that would have been nice to not be in the fray and let people bat this back and forth for a while to prove their absolute stupidity.
I just want to keep going on your point about his daily briefing. Now, there's some presidents who take that daily briefing and comb through it. He supposedly is not one of those. He likes you to stand up and talk, and you know the intel guy talks. You know, but he is not a guy that takes that thing and pours over, you know, his daily briefing.
Who says who?
I can't tell you that.
Yeah, nobody says who. The guy was known as having a stack of newspapers next to his chair when he had an office in Trump Tower. I don't know what he reads and doesn't read.
My point is this. I thought I was going to further your data point till you got insolent. So we'll go from there. All right, and that was this. I mean, it's a data point in a brief.
Yeah.
You know, as Will said before he got insolent. So what? What does it mean that he has people that work for him that are supposed to take that data and bring it to him and say, sir, you need to know this. This is going to action this, and we're going to need a decision relative to this. And so, but again, if you don't understand how this thing kind of comes together, you see like, oh, it was in one of his briefs. How many briefs does he get a day? And do you think that the president logs every bit of data that's in that brief? It's just, but again, and when you see it on TV, it's like, holy shit, man. He blew it off.
The other thing I would say about my point to you is people get out there and say that, you know, that the president doesn't pay. Who said that? John Bolton said that. It's ridiculous. We have no idea how the president actually takes his intel, what he does with it, what he does when he's sitting at his desk. We have no idea, but the worst spin that can come out is what is part of the narrative. And look, believe it or not, people buy the narrative. The president doesn't pay attention to his intelligence.
Well, that's not the point I was making.
You did make it, though. You did.
No, I didn't.
You bought the narrative.
You jumped to it because you're an insolent shit. Okay,
no,
so
you bought the narrative.
No, I didn't buy the narrative. But if I tell you how I know the truth, I can't tell you that, okay? So, but my point is this. When you exist at that level, people are going to portray things that are not accurate, right?
Absolutely.
And they're not accurate. So I think we can agree on that.
Yeah, in the book that comes in, so we used to get a top secret book every day. Delivered up. And I don't know if the PDB was in there or not. I know I used to see it when I was with on the road with Secretary Rice, because she would get it every day.
PDB? But can you make
the President's Daily Brief.
All right.
So the top secret intel book that comes in, though, to all the 4 stars in the Pentagon, that sucker's like an inch thick. You know, it's got a CIA book, a DIA book.
Yeah, and then some asshole says it was in his brief.
Like, yeah.
Oh, really?
It was in his dictionary.
Yes.
It was in his encyclopedia, volume 11.
Right, but you see that, and you see, like, you see congressmen on TV today. You know, at least once it was in his brief, in an inch-thick brief, right, and you're just going, shit. The truth doesn't matter.
And it's interesting, too, because, like, when I worked in that office, that was something that we didn't put on the schedule every day, but the four-star would typically spend some time with that book every day.
Right.
Now, he couldn't – there were days he couldn't. He was out of the office. So one of your jobs is to comb through that thing and be ready to tell him. He said, hey, did you look at the TS book? Yes, sir. I'm going to have him bring it back because you need to see a piece of it. Or, yes, sir, there was nothing interesting or exciting or whatever in there. So you're screening – the book, which is what you're supposed to do to be able to give him something that's actionable at his level.
And if you want, well, hey, let me ask you this. How does it work in the White House? Is there a dude that has the brief that shows up and he's got to sit there in a chair?
Sure.
What's that?
Yeah, I believe that it used to be that the CIA chief would go to the White House every day or his deputy, something like that. They go do the brief. I don't know how it works with the, you know, now we've got the Director of National Intelligence.
Right.
I'm sure that he's on the hook to do the brief or his deputy's on the hook to do the brief. I mean, that's who comes in to talk to the president. You don't get Joe Schmo in there.
Right.
You know, car picks him up at home, dumps him off the White House 7 o'clock in the morning. He walks in at 7:15 and does the brief, however many days a week the president wants. It should be actual. It's 30 minutes max on his calendar.
Holy shit, really with all the stuff that's going on, 30 minutes, man.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It's got to be. It's got to come down to, as Mac pointed out.
Thank you.
It's got to come down to something useful at the executive level, because you consider the volume of intelligence that we gather every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's amazing, and that's why, you know, to me. And I don't know if I mentioned this on Monday, but, you know, after September 11th, people pointed back and, you know, it's like, see, we did have reporting that said it was there. Yeah, but it's an unconfirmed source reporting for the first time. And, yeah, he told the truth. But in with 9,000 other bits of information that came in that four-hour period, where does that go in the stack? And the answer is at the bottom.
And beyond that, the Russians are paying bounty to kill Americans. Well, let's see how many can we trace back to being incentivized by this bounty? Almost none, if any.
None.
Hey, have them keep it up. At least they're not making mayhem somewhere else in the world. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
So I thought that the other shoe that dropped was. You know, you have essentially the two intel organizations, the NSA that does electronic type gathering and eavesdropping, and then you have the CIA, which does human primarily. And so that's – they disagreed. And what was interesting in the Wall Street Journal story said that the NSA disagreed adamantly with the CIA. So in the initial reporting, it said the CIA has confirmed – and you're like, wait a minute, I don't understand. The CIA's confirmed this, but somehow or other it doesn't get to the president or, you know, and then the other shoe drops, but the NSA said no, and then the Pentagon says, we can't corroborate it. And so you're like, oh, I see, some human, and then when you, again, just when you have what we did, you know, you knew that, you know, these guys lie. They'll tell you what they think you want to hear. You know, and so then the pieces of the story begin, and then you think, you know what, this is an unsubstantiated mosaic that somebody's using for political juice. Now the story the story that will go forward isn't even true. That will be irrelevant. You know, what the story is, and I agree with Will in terms of the president, you know, the story will be, what did he know and when did he know it? Right.
Oh, the old Nixon thing. You're right.
All right. So anyway, all right, I want to shift gears a little bit now. July 1st marks the 265 would be 35, 36, 37, and 20. 57th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, I think.
How many?
257th.
200. When did you go to public school in California?
157.
Catholic school?
Yeah.
Didn't they fight in 1763?
No.
1763. Oh, shit.
You know that.
Will, I'm getting sick of you and your little math assholeness here towards me.
37 plus 100, man.
Sorry about that. Okay,
37
so
plus 120.
It's the 357th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg.
In the Islamic calendar, it may be.
There
hey,
you go.
Mac, you could be a media guy with your understanding of the facts.
Don't go there. You're already
CNN,
on thin ice.
I hear CNN calling. Get a
hold of the spectrum, you know, he's done that show for 4 years, but goddamn, he's making some progress now. He said Gettysburg was 357
years ago. No. Well, in spite of him not being gay, we'll hire him.
No, I have no chance. So Gettysburg. So two questions that I want to kind of go around the table. So we'll go around the table twice. The campaign starts down on the banks of the Rappahannock River down by Fredericksburg, and both armies have been encamped for the winter. And so is there what about the Gettysburg campaign attracts your attention as guys who read history and study this kind of shit? Will?
I think what's really interesting to me is how, you know, the Union side is changing horses like in midstream. And this is your first campaign. And you've got, Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia heading to Pennsylvania. And you got Washington, D.C. You'd never been in charge of anything. And you got to give a certain amount of credit for sort of keeping it together on the side of the Union just to not get way out over their skis and get overextended, being overly aggressive, being overly cautious. And it's hard to really understand the mindset. Because we won the battle, we won the war, but I think things were probably pretty nervous there, at the commanding general's tent for quite a while.
So Meade replaces Hooker and as Will said, now we're going to do this. And the interesting thing is they don't know it. Gettysburg's, they don't even know about Gettysburg because it hasn't happened
no.
yet. So it's just they're just trying to get their shit together under another new commanding general. Jeff, how about you? About the campaign.
Well, the campaign. First of all, Lee is the second greatest general of the Civil War. The first, in my opinion, was General Grant. But what he does is he's too weak to stay in the defense. He knows, even though he's been pretty successful doing strategic offensive maneuvers in a limited way in Virginia, and then using tactical measures to win battles like in Fredericksburg, and then the crazy, envelopments and stuff like that to happen in Chancellorsville. He knows that, I can't keep going like this because I'm running out of, I don't have the combat endurance that the Union has because of their industrial base. So he invades the North. In much more audacious way than he did when they fought in Antietam, and he learned a little bit, and he's looking for he's going way north, and his point is he wants to inflict a defeat that threatens the capital even more dramatically than if he had won at Antietam, and so I give him kudos for that, because that's courage, really, because the safe thing to do is to just do the entrenching thing and continue on in a strategic way what he won in a tactical way at places like Fredericksburg and like in the Seven Days Battles and stuff. So you know, I got to give the guy that because he's really got the whole thing in his hands. But the other thing about it is that gets me is the burgeoning rise of competent junior commanders in the Union Army. Like the first one that jumps to mind right away is
wait a minute. Why do you get two? Why do you get two?
Okay, then if only gets one, then that's what I'm sticking with.
All right, Lee. All right, Timmy, your turn. We'll come back to you, Jeff.
Okay,
Timmy.
Because I can go on forever,
As we know. Timmy, unmute yourself.
Tim, come to the light.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God. I cannot believe I did that again.
Dumber than a fence post.
I know. Jesus Christ. So what Jeff was saying, I think, is what grabs me on the campaign level, because Lee cuts – he's just going to do without his line of supply. Unlike Antietam, he's going to take a little bit of a deeper cut into the north. And once he starts rampaging up through the north countries, not having to worry about his own supply lines or anything like that, I'm sure he thought that he would be able to end the war, and he damn near did.
The reason I cut Jeff off was he was going to make my point. So it's not like I didn't give a shit.
I knew it.
If Jeff made 2 points or anything, like I give a shit. But he was going to make my point, so I hacked him off of the knee because he already had one. What happens as they go north, you have Buford now, right, in charge of the cavalry that's screening the Blue Ridge Mountains, the gaps that, you know, so the they're watching the Confederates as they go north. You have Reynolds and the First Corps, just competent and you know, Jeff alluded to, you know, Hancock. You had all these guys that there's this metamorphosis. And what happens during the campaign is every time there's an important decision that has to get made, every time they're at a critical spot, one of these guys is standing there and does the right thing. And it's to me what you don't know. You know, it's kind of under the surface. These guys have all come up, and it's the first string for the Union. And you know, as they go north, I mean, a lot of these guys. I want to say that Hancock's from Pennsylvania, Reynolds is from Pennsylvania, Buford's from Kentucky, so he doesn't really give a shit. But they talk about they have fought him mostly in Virginia. Now they're going back north, and that has a little bit of an impact on everybody's thoughts too. Is that I never thought I'd be going back into my native state to fight the Army of Northern Virginia. But the first string, and they don't really know it yet, but the first string is now, with the exception of Sickles, is now in charge for the Union. And And Sickles almost Sickles just almost delivers it. Okay, how about the battle? Is there a part of the battle, Timmy, you want to go first, that you enjoy reading about or studying more than others?
I do, and it's the part of the battlefield I never went to, and that would be on the East Fields on the third day, where Custer and the 5th Michigan and a bunch of other guys basically blunted the attempt to Stuart, and that monster General Hampton from South Carolina to come into the rear and basically collapse the rear in order to allow Pickett's charge to be driven home. I think that saved the Union's ass. And Custer deliberately disobeyed his orders from his divisional commander, who was called, I think, Kilpatrick called Kill Cavalry, and was supposed to be in the South fighting with the 20th Maine. And he ignored him because he saw all the Confederate cavalry massing on that East Road, and the Union went and charged them repeatedly. I mean 5,000 against 12,000. It was a massively brave and expensive battle, but it saved the Union, I believe.
Yeah, it's a big north of the city. There's this big open plateau, and Custer. I want to say he fights in 21 of the 23 different campaigns with the Army of Northern Virginia, graduates from West Point. He's like 22, 23 years old, right? Young guy.
Right.
And he's one of those guys, kind of like MacArthur, in that, you know, he sees like Union cavalry and they're unlimbering their artillery, and he looks around, where's my bugler? Sound the charge, son. And with that, they light off for these artillery batteries that are shooting like grape shot and canister and shit, like machine guns, right? And everybody gets whacked except Custer. I mean, and it happens.
That's the weirdest thing.
It happens to him over and over, to the point where guys, he wears a red scarf, right? Him and his long ass hair and all that bullshit. And again, much like MacArthur taking the, you know, the frame out of his cover and shit like that, he puts on a red scarf, and his troopers all start wearing red scarves because they're like, hey, that motherfucker wears a scarf and he never gets a scratch. I'm wearing that son of a bitch. But he's just and his luck runs out at the Little Bighorn. But I mean, throughout the Civil War, I mean, his record is really amazing. And he's in the room when they sign the surrender at Appomattox. At Appomattox.
As was what was his main enemy there?
Hampton was one of them.
Was it Hampton? Yeah.
Hampton and Story. Yeah, Hampton was the guy that survived. He was a massively huge dude. Richest man in the South, too. Outfitted his whole cavalry.
Timmy, there's a guy whose name started with an R who was in the Union side, who was I can't remember it now, but he was also, he was finding himself opposite Custer a lot of times, especially after Gettysburg. But I can't remember his name.
Rossner?
Yes, that's him.
How about that for some Civil War nice bullshit history? Yeah.
Good for you, man. Good for you, Mac. You could have said Walter Raleigh, I would agree, but it was Rossner. Yeah.
John Hancock?
Yeah.
John Hancock gets in my head about this time, because my favorite document, American historical document, is the Declaration of Independence. Because nothing says fuck you like the Declaration of Independence. It's a pissed off fuck you document, and I have it in my head now. And somebody, I was doing this little monologue about my love of the Declaration of Independence. And supposedly, right, that the thing that pissed off King George was that everybody had the balls to sign it. And, like, they unroll the thing, and he looks at it like, what the fuck? And he looks at his court jester or whoever, his aide, and his staff second says, what font did Hancock sign his name in? Oh, that's the fuck you font, sir. That's what I thought. We'll go to war with these bastards over this shit. So whenever I see the John Hancock thing, I remember that. The fuck you font. Anyway. So, Will, your favorite part of the Battle of Gettysburg?
Yeah, it's, 20th Maine. And what gets me is you take a amateur soldier, which most of the guys were, who becomes a professional in the breach. And recognizes that he's too weak to defend, and so orders fixed bayonets and charge. And so one individual decision really turns the tide. And then you follow Chamberlain through the rest of the war, and he takes the ceremonial surrender at Attucks, and then lives after being shot through the guts. Lives until like 1914. So one person at the right place at the right time makes a decision that really echoes through history. And it's also just a really, on the physical battlefield itself, it's just a great place to think that you're standing right here where Joshua Chamberlain and 20th Maine were actually standing 137 years ago.
Then that battlefield is, pretty much the same.
He's the William Dean Hawkins of the Civil War, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Except he lives.
If we had another bar, we should name that one the chamber. I guess.
Jeff, how about you? Your favorite moment?
I got to agree. That that one always chokes me up, the Chamberlain one, because in a way, in a tactical sense, he's doing what Lee was doing in a strategic sense. He's too weak to stay in the D. He's almost out of ammo. You know, the only thing he has in his favor is he's on the high ground. And so it's just like Lee. Lee's thinking, you know, I'm running out of bullets and bandages and beans and stuff. I gotta bring this thing. I gotta bring this boil to a head. So he invades the deep north, you know, by their lights. And in a way, Chamberlain's doing the same thing. He's like, they gotta be close to the end if we are, because they're coming uphill at us again and again. These crazy, you know, non-English speaking weirdos. I mean, we're screaming the whole time they're coming. They, despite all that, they got to be close to, you know, to their culminating point. I think if we hit them right now, we'll be successful. And even if we're not, what choice do we have in his mind? You know, here's a guy who's a rhetoric professor, who's the most unrhetorical guy. When he talks to his guys, you know, he just gets right to the point. So I got to go with, you know, Will on that one. Plus, I have to tell you, all the literature, particularly like William Schirra's
Killer Angels,
you know, Killer Angels. It's so eloquently put.
In the spirit of being a dick, since Will started this, I believe it's Michael Schirra.
You are. You're right. It is Michael Schirra. And yeah, but anyways,
see what you
it's actually his nickname though was Shifty Schirra, but he was a boxer in the 50s after the Korean War.
What?
A lot of people don't know that. No. But anyway, he fought. He was a fighter. Schirra is a real Renaissance figure, as they used to say. You know? And
what?
Go ahead, Will.
I didn't start this. I just continue it. So,
my favorite part is the guy who gets Chamberlain. Actually, puts Chamberlain is Chamberlain's brigade commander, and there's a guy named Strong Vincent. He's from Pennsylvania.
He gets killed. Yeah.
Yeah. He dies a couple of days later. He bleeds to death, but he's shot through the femoral artery. But the whole brigade is on the back side of the wheat field. In the reserve, mm-hmm. And Governor Warren, the engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers, he goes. The great story, his statue's up there, right? He goes up on top, a little round top, and he pulls out his binoculars, and he sees Longstreet's corps extending its right flank towards Big Round Top, and he's like, "Oh my fucking god!" And Sickles has moved out to the Emmitsburg Pike, and he's like, "We're about to lose," and he sends a courier that's with him with a note to General Davis, who's commanding, I can't remember what division, and he says, bring your division here, and Strong Vincent is sitting on his horse, and he sees the courier ride by, and he's looking, and he says, you know, "Hey, who are you looking for?" "Sir, I'm looking for General Davis." You know, and he said, he was there, and he says, "Give me that communications." And the courier says, "No, sir, it's for General Davis." And he says, "Give it to me, I'll take responsibility." So he reads it, and he says, "Tell General Davis, right, I'm headed for yonder round top." Because it didn't have a name at that point. So he goes up there, and he looks, and he's like got the oh fuck moment going through, like, oh fuck.
Yeah.
So they come back, and you know, he urges his brigade along, and they go over that hill, and he's setting them in place, and there's crazy shit that happens up there. There's a
right.
I want to say a West Point guy by the name of Patrick O'Rourke. His regiment's in a column of fours with fixed bayonets. They don't even deploy online. He just says he sees what's going on. He says, "Sound the charge."
That's right.
I mean,
he does AP Hill on it.
Yeah, so they get it the fuck on Little Round Top, and then you have the rhetoric professor with the droopy mustache in the back. And, right. You know, because, come on, he's a rhetoric professor. What the fuck's he going to do? And then, right. You know, he winds up becoming a hero. But so, I mean, that thing hangs in the breach, you know, throughout the Saturday afternoon. And at every point, the division engineer steps up and does what he's supposed to do. And then, you know, a brigade commander, you know, does something that you didn't read very often happen in the Civil War, which is to flag down the courier, you know, and then take the initiative.
Yeah.
Right, to take the initiative, to coordinate his initiative, right? And then people do the right thing, and you know,
because think about it, man. The Union Army then was they're the deep state army. They're the guys who are like trying to get pensions, trying to get promoted. They believe in the system. The rebel army is all a bunch of guys who are they're putting their asses on the line. They either got to win or it's a very uncertain future for them. So you got to give them that. But by that time, all those ass whippings happen in 1862 and into the middle of 1863. Finally, the Union had guys who were like saying, "Fuck this, we got to win."
Yeah, you know? No, they had good. I mean, those guys and at Gettysburg, every time from day one when you have the fight west of the city when Buford's just a stud and Reynolds.
You guys remember John Buford at the basic school? I was amazed at how much he looked like the guy in the Buford from the Civil War. You know, the Buford from day one at Gettysburg. I knew they're related,
I talked to him a year ago. He's still living in the vicinity.
Yeah.
He's a good dude.
Obvious relation.
Timmy?
Yeah, he was a good guy.
No, I said Buford is related to him. He was the XO when I was a 3 at 1-8. So I deployed with him too. Yeah, John was a direct descendant.
No, you know who I'm thinking of? Not John Buford. I'm thinking of John Nettles.
Yeah, no, oops. Buford, yeah.
You mean third base?
Yes.
Third
yes.
base.
Yes.
Yeah, Buford is like he might be a principal football coach type of thing in a school down in Florida. That's where he moved to. And then I think I've seen recently he's gotten his PhD as some sort of an educator. Yeah, really solid guy and a spitting image. And I think it's his three greats or four greats grandfather was
Buford. Buford dies less than a year later of like typhoid.
Yeah, I think he got sick.
He dies of typhoid or some shit like that. But if you go to the battlefield, we used to go and if you take firsthand resources and you turn it into a decision exercise, you would have lieutenants who didn't even like history and would come up to you later on. You know, we'd always wind up in a bar someplace and they would come up and like, "Sir, I don't even like history. And this was fucking awesome." You know?
Yeah. You know, I have to tell you, remember there's the movie Gettysburg, the guy who played, General Reynolds, right? He reminded me so much of John Allen. So I go on, I'm a company commander in 2-2, and the way they did Muse was you went and you evaluated the same type of company. So I was evaluating Will for that Mew when Will was in 2-6. But we started out in the big deck. So I'm on the big deck, and I told General Allen, "He reminded me of the guy who played Reynolds in Gettysburg." He goes, "I don't find that a compliment, Jeffrey." But I know you meant it that way. And then I flew over to Will's ship, where Will was living like a king.
What?
Because Will was CO troops. What was that ship, Will? It was a new LSD.
What is your saying? They just recognize greatness, I think, is what Will was.
Whidbey Island. It wasn't new.
Whidbey Island, yeah. The Whidbey. And I was on like three floats of the Whidbey, but I never even saw it except from a distance
until you went to Will's Imperial Court there. One other thought was that I remember doing and again when the decision exercises, decision making exercises, I think we go around to five different spots, right? Reynolds, do you stay or do you fight or fall back on day one west of the city? There was a bunch of them, but one of them was, I want to say, in the wheat field, and it's I think it was Freeman McGilvery, and I mean, he retires his artillery battery by prologue, which meant they fired the son of a bitch and let it recoil and run down the hill a little bit, then they'd fire it again and fire it again, and there was nobody around them, and there's this hole blown in the wheat field, and so you're sitting there, and we only use first-person accounts. So, I mean, the pronouns were I and shit like that.
Right.
And it was just, I mean, it was just, you know, you and again, the battlefield's still, similar. And you'd be sitting there like, holy shit, man, you could see it. You know, we looked across yonder meadow with smoke like clinging to the ground. And then we saw, you know, their gray and butternut uniforms. And you're reading these things. And because they wrote, that was a form of communication. And they could all write, at least, you know, the ones that wrote reports and out of battles and records of the Civil War and stuff like that. And you'd read these things. And they were just awesome, awesome. And it, I mean, literally, you'd be sitting there on your campstool going, shit, this is awesome. And then the other thing you would, the lieutenants would get out of it was, you know, I mean, the friction and uncertainty that these guys went. We did not know, right? We did not know what size unit lay on the other side. You know, we fell back later to find out it was a, you know, it was a battalion or something like that. And so, interesting stuff.
It's like Sickles doing that senseless attack. I mean, it turns into, like, it's almost like 3-2 and 1-8 in Tarawa, where there's, like, no reason. They're just getting butchered, you know what I mean, to no end. And it's like, it reminded me of that type of, you know, why the fuck are we doing this? What was this part of the plan? You know, me walking in with my rifle over my head, getting shot. And, you know, that's the thing that struck me about, you know, the whole thing. The thing about Gettysburg was the battle of well, it's for all battles, really, but for Gettysburg especially, because it's so famous. The fight against uncertainty on both sides. What the fuck is really going on?
Right. Well, and then, you know, Stuart, yeah. You know, he totally fucks up the campaign because, he's out trying to be a celebrity. And then he shows up, you know, on the second day. The other thing that I think I'll tell you one more thing, a curious thing that you don't think is very well known. I'd be curious to hear what everybody has to say about that. And I'll give you mine first so nobody steals it. Lee, if you read the writings of, I want to say there was a Prussian guy who was with them. There was a Brit and a French guy traveling with the Army of Northern Virginia. And Lee lines up, you know, so Pickett's charge, you know, all that way across, right? That long, long, you know, open area at Gettysburg, right? Well, what Lee tried to do, and the artillery guys fucked him up, was he lined up like 263 tubes of artillery, hub to hub to hub. Right. Nobody had ever seen anything like this, and he was going to blow. He was going to blow them right off the forward slope of the of Cemetery Ridge. But the Artie guys, as they will, fucked it up. They overshot the targets. If they would have walked those rounds up the hill, right, and then the smoke obscured the valley, or you know that little, you know, where Emmitsburg Pike is, you know, and they couldn't see, they couldn't spot the rounds. They were seeing the explosion, but the explosions were happening in the field trains of the Union Army, and so the guys on the forward slope didn't get hit, and then it did become a forlorn motherfucking hope, man. The plan,
and you know, you're right. Not many people know about that.
No, the plan was Lee was gonna hammer the shit out of them, hammer them right into the reverse slope of that, you know, with his artillery. And they fucked it up. Porter Wagner, he's like a hee-haw guy, I think. I do.
I don't know if he was at Gettysburg. He probably visited, though.
No, Porter Wagner's in Nashville, I'm pretty sure, with Buck Owens and the Buckaroos. Jeff, a little known fact or something you find curious about Gettysburg?
Well, no. I mean, I think everything I know is what everything most people know. But I mean, you know what I'm saying? So I think to me the most, you know, the most compelling thing about it was that Dan Sickles attack. I don't know if most people know how senseless that was, you know, because, you know, the whole Peach Orchard thing and all that stuff, that if the guy had hung back and did what he's ordered to do, it would have been a lot better for him and his people.
Oh my God.
But then if you look at the history of Dan Sickles, you know, it kind of makes sense, I guess.
Solid performer is not one of the things you're going to see in his section C.
Yeah, I know. But he was a man who defended his wife's honor, even when she wasn't honorable, you know, Didn't he like, and then didn't he insist on being buried with his leg? I can't remember, but it's like the, I don't know if a lot of people know about that. Remember he lost his leg there. And, yeah, you know, it's like, but he was very, he was possessive of his wife and his leg, even though it was blown off. And he wanted to be with both of them, despite the betrayal both of them had given to him.
To the
and
end.
His horse, who was he was riding when he lost his leg. So, yeah.
All right. Timmy, maybe a lesser known fact or something you find, you know, quizzical or about Gettysburg?
Well, the only thing I would do, and I've done this once before, because you and I have done this once before, is that the artillery barrage that you described, part of the reason that worked with the Union for the Union side was the Union gunners within 2 hours into that thing stopped firing back. In order to allow make the rebels think that they're having an effect on the guns. They couldn't see because of the smoke. But the Union stopped firing for 2 hours, did not fire a shot until they got enough rebels into the field that they could hit them with the canister. And then they started unleashing on them. So there's a little-known fact appended to your little-known fact.
Yeah.
That is very good.
When you read when you read accounts of, Pickett's division and Pettigrew, and they talk about the effect of Union's artillery, especially from the vicinity of Little Round Top and where it was enfilade firing. You know, they're like shooting steel bowling balls down the length of your division, right?
With chains and rocks and all kind of other shit.
Yeah. Like, look, I'm out of here. And then, you know, then you got like the chaplain for the Irish Brigade stands up on a rock. Right before, I think it's day three or maybe day two, they were going to the wheat field, and he stands up. He goes, "Remember, boys, the Catholic Church denies Christian burial to anybody who runs from their colors." Right, and I'm kneeling next
Good
to
for Je- him.
I'm kneeling
need
next
that guy now.
I'm kneeling next to Jeff, going, "Fuck, I'm totally fucked. I'm totally fucked right now. I just got off the boat a month ago, man, and now if I take off,
I don't even speak English. I'm from Western Ireland.
If I take off, I'm going to hell? What the fuck? I'm screwed. All right. Will?
Yeah, the only thing I would say is, the historical what if. What happened if Meade actually attacks on day four and routs Lee's army?
We win the war.
Yeah, but then think about it. There's no subjugation of the South.
Why not?
There's no Sherman's March. There's no a lot of things that happen in the future that make it so that they have to actually surrender because they are beaten thoroughly and they know it.
So the narrative. You know,
it could be very, very different ending of the war if it ended in 1863. There would have been less casualties up front, but it may have been, and it's not like we had a great reconciliation. But
you're right.
You know, it's sort of a
That's
Germany
fascinating.
After the end of the
that
First
is
World
fascinating,
War.
Fascinating, Will. It's like, what if the Germans had succeeded in assassinating Hitler in July 22nd or the 20th of 1944, and then there is a peace, but Germany would – it's almost the same type of thing. What would happen, you know, would the world look like?
It's like Germany after the First World War. Germany after the First World War – because they weren't defeated on, you know, it just sort of, you know, you see a lot of that beat around in the history that, he should have attacked, he couldn't attack. But if he would have, think of the huge potential different outcome of the whole war. Right. Because in the end, right, the only person that's defeated is because they know they're beaten. There would have been a lot of people and stuff that did not know they were beaten. So, anyway.
Interesting.
Yep, I agree. Interesting. Everybody's getting letters from home that's occupied by the Union. You're right.
And Lee, as they come back from Pickett's charge, is saying, "It's my fault. It's my fault." But what he's thinking is, fucking Stuart and fucking Alexander have fucked this thing up for me. And now I've got to get my ass across that fucking river. But he's a regal gentleman, so he didn't want to verbalize that. Last thing we'll talk about is internet and cell phones have created this Orwellian thing that we're living through right now, where federal government and the state government believes that they can control the population, and they do. And I just wondered if you guys, you know, have any thoughts on that. Because, I mean, heretofore, what would have happened is we wouldn't have stopped school. Kids would have continued to go to school. We would have gone to work, and people would have got sick. And slowly but surely, we would have either developed herd immunity or figured it out or somebody, you know. But there was never the opportunity to attempt to, you know, control the population. And now, you know, you see people saying that, oh, we should have done this, or we should have shut down here. We should have done this. It's like you can grab the joystick and do what you will with 325 million people. And, you know, and so anyway, Jeff, thoughts on the Orwellian nature and this kind of, you know, this kind of, it seems like that's how public health officials believe that somehow or other they can rule the nation and mitigate against this stuff. I'd be curious about your thoughts about the whole Orwellian thing.
Yeah, my thoughts are that most of our elected leaders have got no historical perspective on any of this stuff. And so they just thought, if I don't do what this guy says, I'm going to be painted as a guy who's callous about American lives. And so consequently, we surrendered meekly all of our basic rights that are laid out in the Constitution. Everything from the First Amendment all the way through, you know, the first eight. I mean, and to the point where these people think all they got to do is declare some kind of contrived emergency. They can tell us to shut up. They can tell us you got to stay in your house. You can't go to work. These are all the things we fought the revolution and for that matter, the Civil War to go against. This is business as usual in the rest of the world, but not here. And this thing happened. We should recognize it and not let it happen anymore. Because as Tim has pointed out masterfully again and again, this thing was never all that. You know, it was based on a bunch of computer models, you know, from sketchy sources, and that, well, to be safe, we better do the most extreme thing. And we've come close to ruining the greatest economy that actually affects not just the country, but the whole world, you know, based on fear of the unknown. And then, of course, you throw in the political stuff. How can different political people use this to their advantage? You know, we're in the situation we're in now, but I think it's totally overblown and people should start suing and stay. I mean, I'm not a big, you know, legal guy, but I'm saying this is a time when it's justified. The overstepping that local and state governments particularly have made on the rights of American people is disgusting. It's disgusting. And the deaths don't warrant it. They don't, our deaths have not even gone above the normal, you know, 7,000 to 8,000 deaths a month that happen in the United, or a week that happen in the United States, even with this thing. So it's, you know, it's something we should really deal with.
All right.
That's my opinion.
Well, Orwellian country. What are your thoughts?
I think, the biggest downfall of like instant communications and the internet is that there doesn't appear to be critical thinking on anything. There's a piece of video, so that's the truth. You know, you throw in social media, which is not a forum that like encourages and respects dissent and critical thinking. It's about, you know, who can turn the phrase the best. And, you know, with the internet, so you've got every bit of information in the history of the world at your fingertips. Are we actually any better? Go back and read, I think it's Crisis of the House Divided. It's about the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And you read about Lincoln and Douglas debating slavery in 1858 for hours on end, and their ability to command the language, to marshal an argument, to refute an opposite argument. They didn't have the internet. they actually had to know things and think about things. So, you know, Google's mission to organize all the information in the world, I think it made us a lot dumber. And the future doesn't bode well.
Just so everybody knows, because I know these kind of things, crisis of the House divided, an interpretation of the issues in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, 50th anniversary edition, by Harry Jaffa. And you can buy that on Amazon. Timmy?
Well, as for an example of how weird things are, if you take any three numbers, that doesn't matter the combination, and type them into a browser, any browser, and after that put number cases. So let's say 333 number cases, 667 number cases. You hit that and you'll get hundreds of stories with exactly that number related to COVID-19 on any browser with any three number combination. Now that's weird. I don't know what that is. I think that's some kind of automation that the news services do with government out. I don't know, but it makes you suspicious. And then you start thinking about all the modifications that are being made in your life because of shit that's on your phone right now. And I'll give you an example. If you're a USAA member and you wanted to enroll in their safe driving program, you put their safe driving program in the app and you figure, I've got no tickets, I've got no issues, I'm a safe driver. But if you've got a late model car, that app is talking to your car. And every time you speed, it's narking you out. Every time you do a hard stop, it narks you out. If you start weaving in the lane, it narks you out to USAA, and you ain't a safe driver anymore. So now I meticulously follow surface street mile per hours, and I resent the shit out of it. I'm a much safer driver. But I'm being manipulated by a goddamn app. I'm being manipulated into being a safe driver.
For how much?
I resent that.
Matt, for how many shekels? For how many shekels have you whored yourself out to USAA, Timmy?
I have no idea. I'm not a safe driver. Apparently, it doesn't seem to reflect anything on my.
So then, but take the fucking thing off your car and have and live your life the way you want to live, man.
No, I'm just giving an example of technology already kind of modifying behavior.
Oh, I thought you meant
you've pointed out with this shutting things down. Oh, the COVID's flaring in South Texas now. We got to keep everybody indoors. I mean, come on, man. We already know that all the projections that all this has been based about this alleged science turned out not to be real accurate. And what's amazing to me is how often All Marine Radio is ahead of the story. If you want to hear anything that's remotely intelligent about policing, the only thing to listen to was you and Jack was Hoban, right?
Hoban, yeah.
Yeah, Hoban, right? That's the – and I've listened – I consume podcasts, bro. I've listened to a lot. If you're a Joe Rogan fan listener, just last week you learned about the modes of transmission and the gain of function with the COVID. And that was a 2-hour pedantic explanation like a guy was revealing the secrets of the lost universe. We were talking about that a month ago. You go back to the Iran rocket stuff, and you, All Marine Radio, consistently are ahead of the story compared to the press right now. And why can't a bunch of retired Marine officers figure this crap out when nobody else is? It's weird, man. Well, so we're getting manipulated by apps.
Don't underestimate the intellectual horsepower of retired Marine officers, okay?
Yeah, but don't underestimate
it's consistent. I'm giving us all a pat on the back, but consistently we're ahead of where the mainstream story is. Just this week, they started seeing all the real smart guys talk about the four olds. Me and Jeff were talking about that 2 weeks ago.
Hold on.
That's all I know.
Apps
will ruin your life. You should get a flip phone. Is my opinion.
Will has something. Will has something to say. William.
Here's an Orwellian thing in the internet. So I follow a guy on YouTube who has a channel about chess, and he got banned from YouTube for violating community standards. The only thing he can figure out is in describing chess matches, he talks about the positions of white and black. And part of his verbiage is white is always better here. If the white pieces have a better positional advantage. And so he got flagged by the AI running YouTube and got banned for violating community standards.
I find that entirely appropriate.
Orwellian. That is Orwellian.
Yeah, I'll just tell you. I mean,
the world.
I think if you brought Mr. Orwell right back, he would look around and go, "What the fuck? I never thought." Right? It'd be like if you brought Jefferson back and sat him down and say, "This is what we've done to the Constitution." He would look at it and go, "Are you shitting me? We're there now? Well, that's interesting." Yeah, I'm the same feeling. Like, we did what? I'll tell you what. I hate to agree with Will tonight, but I will.
It's hard not to.
But the whole critical thinking, fuck. I get my news from Facebook, right? Like, are you shitting me? Right. Yeah. And it's just, and then you hear them, and I don't care what story you want to talk about that we kind of drill into, you know, Will's phrase earlier, it does it on Monday. You can't get to the third question on the son of a bitch. It doesn't answer the mail. And so we don't get to the third question. And you know, the future is straight up terrifying, right? Terrifying. I mean, well, this is not going to turn around. This is not going to turn around and go the other way.
Yeah. I think there's still fear on the other side about U.S. The U.S. government as related to the basics, the Constitution, and the, our belief in the rule of law, because I think a lot of this stuff, I mean, I'm hoping I'm right, is a function of a huge smokescreen in some cases being thrown up because this guy Barr is implacable. Barr and this guy,
that guy,
the guy in Connecticut, Durham, they're like, holy shit, we're getting indications of what's coming out. And if this comes out, we're going to look like SHIT. So we got to muddy the waters.
Wait a minute. I've said motherfucker on this show 3 times and you just spelled shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes sometimes Jesus talks to me, Matt.
What does he say to you?
Although this isn't one of those talks.
Jeffrey? Does he
I'm always looking out for you. I don't want to, like,
Does he speak to you in Aramaic or does he speak English?
I just have feelings that come over me. That's how he talks to me. But he said to me a couple times, Jeff, your bad behavior is going to fuck Mac up, and then you'll be blamed for all.
So of all the things that you said on the son of a bitch that I've edited out, now you decide to spell. Now you decide to spell shit. Now is this like latent effects of the IDs that have blown the shit out of you, or what?
No,
how
Jeff,
the fuck
Jeff
would I know? I'm the last guy who would know that. Man, what a dumb question. I would say yeah, of course.
Now, Jeff knows that my mom is listening.
So. Oops.
There you go. That's it. Oops. And my mom, and worse, my mom may be listening. You never know where she gets around to. And I don't want to get – that's an ass-chewing I want to have.
I didn't
– I lie to my mom just to avoid ass-chewing. You know, I mean, I stopped lying to her when I was like 15, but I started again late as she was getting older because I don't want her last thing in life to be telling me I'm a jerk, you know?
Hey, that's solid planning there.
Okay, we'll end on this. Yeah. Give me your favorite memory of your mother. Timmy, your favorite memory of your mom.
My favorite memory of my mother, I think, was when I would drive, or she would come pick me up from OCS, those few weekends we had off, and make me a big old dinner, and I'd go to sleep in her house for like 20 hours. And she was just so solicitous. She was so proud that I was going and doing that. And she was taking such great care of me. And I just remembered that she was so she was just a super asset. I was just I felt very close to her then. And I thought she'd be pissed at me about going to Marine Corps, but she wasn't.
And so you went home every weekend and your mom took care of you. What the fuck?
Yeah. We got 3 weekends? The last 3 weekends we could get liberty. Just go and sleep somewhere.
And the rest of us are down at the PX with everybody else hating us because we look like idiots and our clothes are all wrinkled and shit.
Yeah, I know.
And you're at home with your mommy taking care of you. Will, your favorite memory of your mom since she's listening?
I don't know if I have a favorite memory. I have consistent memories is that my mother is always she's always sort of been there when went on deployment, came home. Even when she wasn't there physically, I knew she was there. I was always proud. And she grew up an Army brat. But always proud of her son and of her grandson for being Marines. And that's been a big deal for me. We were deployed in Iraq in the front yard in a place in upstate New York, which is I've described as Berkeley of the East. You know, they had a American flag out there, and we support our troops. And they took a certain amount of flack from some people in the neighborhood. They also got a lot of support. It just meant a lot to me that she's been very supportive of me being a Marine, and then always since then. So. I'm not sure I have a favorite memory, and hopefully I got time to get more favorite memories as I go forward.
Wow. Well, well done. Jeff, your favorite memory of your mom?
Yeah. Now, my favorite memory of my mom, I was 7 years old. And my middle brother, who's younger than me, was an infant. And my sister is 2 years younger than me. And there's this huge – we're living in Hartford, Connecticut. And we're living about a mile and a half or so away from the actual – like Constitution Plaza near where Mark Twain lived. It was a highly ethnic neighborhood. We had a 3-family house we were living in. So it's pouring rains and lightning. I mean, lightning had hit a tree down the street. She says, she looked at me, she goes, "Jeffrey, you want to put on our bathing suits and go running out in this?" I went, "Yeah." And my sister was crying because it was a thunderstorm from hell. And me and my mom went out and ran up and down the – and it was like there was a hill with mud on it. And we slid down the mud hill. I mean, what? She must have been – she was 23 when I was born, so she was like 30. And she worked all night long at Hartford Hospital. And my dad worked during the day at Pratt & Whitney, and then he worked as a busboy, you know. So they both were working full time. My dad was at work, and I had a blast with her, you know, and I told one of my aunts about it later. She goes, "Your mother used to throw rocks at the kids who lived next door. Your mother," and she was the middle of 11 kids.
Ooh.
And but she was totally. My mom is like Miss Moral Uprightness, you know. But she said, "Jeff, you want to go running out?" And we did it, and it was like 3 hours of running around and stuff, and it was just a. And my relationship with her was different after that, you know?
Oh,
I mean, you know, that, but I knew that I thought my mom's got like a, she got a wild hair for that. She'd be pissed if she heard it now. But, you know, so that was, awesome. I'll never forget that. I think about that a lot, you know, she was that way. She'd been a good, like, company commander, I think.
That's awesome. When I was a kid, I had problems with my, I had a heart murmur and then I had my tonsils out. So I was, before I was 5 or 6, I'd been to the hospital like 2 or 3 different times. And one of my favorite memories is my mom would build models with me, you know, and, you know, you'd be sitting in the bed and you know, that like tray on wheels they would put over the bed.
Yeah.
Right. So my mom would extend it and put newspaper down on the thing. And then she'd bust the, who was the company that made the models?
Hasbro? No.
No, it's not.
Hasbro was a big toy company.
Yeah,
but
it's
was
not Hasbro.
I know you're talking about it. It was,
yeah. They made all these models, battleships, you know, airplanes and all that. And, you know, and she would sit there. And I want to say that we actually used glue back in the day, right? We actually used
airplane
glue in the hospital, and I also want to say that she was allowed to smoke sometimes,
mm-hmm.
which is laughable now, right? But my mom, always very graceful, elegant, you know, woman, and she'd be in her dress, and she would bring me a new Michael. I've got a new model for you. You do. Is it the Hellcat bomb? No, it's not the it's not the Hellcat. It's another one the man recommended. What is it? And I guess she'd bust it out. And then we would build it.
The P-51.
My mom, but again, like, she was not, right, into building models, but she did it for me, yeah. Her son. And so one of my favorite, my mom was the only person when I, again, I don't come from a family of Marines. My dad, my uncle were in the Army, but when I said I was going to join the Marine Corps, everybody, you know, was shocked and dismayed, except my mother. Yep. She said, I think you'll love it. She would buy me. Have you ever seen that Civil War book that they for kids? And there's maps in it, and there's all these intricately painted maps with formations on them and the names of the commanders and shit like that. Have you ever? It's called The Illustrated Civil War for Kids or something like that. My mom bought me that. I used to look at that son of a bitch all the time, and she would buy me. Yep. She would buy me Civil War books. She bought me World War II books. She bought me. I mean, I am the person I am because of my mom, but yeah, she built models. She, you know, the other thing I'll tell you about my mom is I don't think she ever went to a gym class. I got hit by a car and she was in the house adjacent to the street and I rode my bike in the street. I didn't look. Guy slams on the brakes, poof, hits me. I get launched. Kish! I hit the ground and roll. Right. And I mean, I'm skinned up and I look up. And my sister screams, like, Michael's been hit by a car. My mom comes running out of the house, and that almost killed me. She'd never been to gym class. She was running out. I was like, oh, Jesus. I'm lying on the asphalt, right, looking, going, oh, Jesus Christ. The woman's never run in her life. And so I stand up. I apologize to the guy who I rode my bike out front of. And then my mom's yelling at me, are you okay? And I said, I'm fine. My handlebars are crooked. So I couldn't ride my bike home. I had to walk it home. So I'm running my bike home because she told me to go home. My dad was on the roof. He comes off the roof, and he spanks the shit out of me for scaring the shit out of him.
That'll teach you.
Exactly. He said, my heart was in my mouth. You scared the shit out of me. Wham, 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 wham. Get in your room. And I was like, what the fuck, man? I just got hit by a car and spanked. Well, so anyway. All right, boys.
Hey, let me ask a question, though.
Sure.
Your favorite memory, your mother is in a pure oxygen environment. She's smoking and got open airplane throat.
Yeah. Yes. That's a good one. Yeah, fuck it, man. She was my mom. Hell, she probably had a little vin rosé in the bathroom. I just didn't know about it. Right? Yeah. She was going to have to be there like a few days. What the hell? So, well, I mean, hospitals have evolved a little bit, right? I mean,
oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, my mom worked as coronary intensive care unit. My mom wanted to she thought that FDR was an asshole for getting rid of prohibition. So it's like, you know,
what?
Yeah, she thought we should have kept prohibition, my mom.
You know
There's
what? I'll tell you
good
what
that comes from this.
I think,
oh my God.
I think that that's one of the historically that's a prohibition is a really really interesting subject. How the fuck did we convince so many people to amend the Constitution of the United States to outlaw liquor?
It's the first time women got the vote, Mac, and they all the majority of the votes were women who temperance people who voted that way. I mean, I'm not even bullshitting. I'm telling the truth.
Nope.
And because they were sick of their husbands, because it wasn't proper before prohibition for women to go in bars unless you're like a hooker or something. So they hated it. Their husbands come home and beat them up or just throw up and shit, or just be dickheads. So they're the ones, when they got the vote, that was the first thing that happened. When they got the vote in 1919, the first thing that, you know, that was manifested by it was the vote for prohibition.
And I'll tell you what, Ken Burns has an incredible documentary about it. So it was the evangelicals and the woman vote that pushed that thing in most states.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
And my mom would have had it. She says, "You have. There's no use for this thing. You should, especially you, Jeffrey. Good God. You and your father. I swear to God, you're savages."
That is funny. All right, boys. Okay, everybody say goodnight to Will's mom, Pat.
Goodnight,
Pat.
Night, Pat. Will, you going to say goodnight?
You going to say
goodnight,
Mom.
Goodnight, Mom.
Goodnight.
All right, that'll do it. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.